This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
So what were you doing 1,400 weeks ago? It was the spring of 1990, and a new program called The Best of Our Knowledge debuted on WAMC Radio. But enough about that. Let's talk about me. I've only been around for the last 300 of those weeks, but I did go back and listen to the first T-Book I hosted back in 2011. You know what? The topic is still interesting and relevant.
At this one high school, students come from more than 45 different countries and speak more than 28 different languages.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, let's take another listen to my interview with the author who spent a year at a high school for immigrants in New York City and wrote a book about the students she shared that year with. And we'll spend an academic minute finding out if free speech and advertising are a good mix. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In 2002, then-New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg launched an effort to overhaul the city's schools. Failing schools were shut down, and in their place, nearly 200 smaller schools opened around the city. One of these is the International High School at Prospect Heights in Brooklyn. The school opened in 2004 and remains a popular choice for students new to the U.S. To learn more about the school, we spoke to Brooke Hauser, a writer who spent a year with students at the school. Her book about the experience is called The New Kids: Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens, and it won the American Library Association's 2012 Alex Award. Back in November of 2011, I asked her about the school.
Sure. There are actually more than a dozen similar high schools, but the school I was at is called the International High School at Prospect Heights in Brooklyn. And at this one high school, students come from more than 45 different countries and speak more than 28 different languages. So it's kind of like having the entire world underneath one roof. But just imagine, you know, high school and teenagers is a crazy milieu anyway, you could say, but add, you know, dozens of different languages to the mix, and it's really one of the loudest places on earth.
You've compared it to the Tower of Babel.
Noise-wise, but I would say that where they're different is that the International High School is successful because, of course, the Tower of Babel fell, so I don't want to take the comparison too literally. But once you go into the actual classrooms, the kids settle down, they sit at their tables, divide into groups, and the teachers really encourage them to speak English. But, of course, if a kid has just arrived in the United States, you know, they can't speak English. That's why they're at the school. So students are encouraged to use their native languages when necessary in order to help other students in those beginning stages.
And not speaking English is actually one of the criteria for getting into that school, correct?
Right. There are two main criteria for a student to get into the school. One is the student at the time of enrollment has to have lived in the United States for fewer than 4 years. And the other requirement is that the student actually has to fail an English language assessment test in order to get in. So the school and the larger international network for public schools that oversees these high schools, they're really trying to target the kids who are most in need of learning English and who are also recent immigrants or refugees.
What else do kids have to go through to get into the school? Is it just, okay, here I am, I can't speak English, let me in, or is there some kind of criteria, other criteria?
Academically, no. The biggest criteria is that they really, you know, need to be new English language learners, and they need to be new immigrants to the country. Beyond that, the kids who I've seen have come from, in addition to all different ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds, they come from all different academic backgrounds. So as far as content, subject content, there's no test that you have to pass in order to get into the school. I've met kids who were the product of more privileged backgrounds, having gone to a Chinese boarding school. And then I've met kids from West Africa, maybe countries like Sierra Leone and Guinea, who never went to school a day before in their lives. One year there was a girl from West Africa who had never held a pencil before entering the school on the first day of ninth grade. So all the kids are really mixed together in classes, and their levels range dramatically. And so the idea is the kids who have had more education or who are more proficient in English are able to help those who need help. And there's a real emphasis on group work, teamwork, and on the students helping each other to learn.
Is there a big demand for people trying to get into the school? Is there space problems with it?
There is, yeah. You know, it's been national news lately that New York and L.A. are failing to meet the needs of English language learners. And that's New York and L.A., you know, both cities that have huge immigrant populations. I wonder what those statistics would be like for the rest of the country and, you know, small towns, for instance, that don't necessarily have complex English language learning programs or ESL programs set up at their schools. At this school in particular, yes, there's a huge demand, and students are often turned away. And the reason is because this school was set up as, you know, part of the small schools initiative. And the whole point is that classes should be small so that students are getting the most attention from their teachers. So it makes sense that the school isn't able to accommodate all of the new students because they're trying to just do right by the ones that they already have. But it's a sad thing to see a student come into the school and get turned away because it's difficult. It's a never-ending odyssey sometimes to find a good school in New York City, or for that matter, any part of the country, if there's too many kids in one class. So they have to keep looking for a place until they find one.
This book is by no means a story about the school. This is told in dozens of different stories of individual students. What kind of access did you get to the students?
I first got to know the students and the school while writing an article for the New York Times called The Strange Thing Called Prom. And it was about the kids putting on their first ever prom, which was a lot of fun because coming from all these different countries and brand new to America, most of the kids had never heard of prom before, which made the planning of it very difficult. So in the end, the most popular girl was a nomadic yak herder, and it was unlike any other prom you've ever heard of. The school read the article and was very pleased with it. I think it showed the school in good light, and that really helped get me access to the high school for the year that I went back to report, and also to the students. I got to know the students at first by reading their college essays, which were basically chronicles in many cases of how they had come to the United States. And many of their journeys were very dramatic and compelling to read about. One of the boys who I ended up following, his name is Nawang, and he came over from Tibet. And the way he fled Tibet was he hid inside of a small suitcase for 24 hours as a young boy. And the suitcase was put in the back seat of a car headed to the border of Nepal. So, you know, once I read Nawang's story, I thought, this is a kid who I really need to talk to. And I found other kids much in the same way, either by reading their essays or I would ask some of the senior teachers, who are the kids who you can't stop thinking about when you go home at night? And from there, I just set about getting to know the kids in classes and going home with them sometimes and just seeing what life was like for them, both in the school and outside of the school.
Nawang's story was one of the ones I had written down and highlighted. That was an amazing story that he told. What was it like watching these kids over the year kind of become Americanized, or did they actually become Americanized?
It really depends on each kid. That word, I think, has some controversy attached to it at the school because, you know, I think that the students want to adapt and acculturate to life in America, but at the same time, they want to preserve their own identities, especially someone like Nawang, who's from Tibet. The whole reason why he and many of the other kids left Tibet in the first place is because they weren't able to celebrate their own Tibetan culture, language, and customs because of the tight Chinese government control. To someone like Nawang, I think he's in some ways very much, you know, American in some ways, but he's also very Tibetan. You know, he wears Converse sneakers and he has a punky faux hawk, but he also always will attend a Tibetan march or protest. And some of the students have strayed a little farther from their native cultures. Every year there are girls from Bangladesh, for instance, who might decide to stop wearing their headscarves, and maybe they don't practice Islam anymore. So it really depends on each student. But I would say, for the most part, the kids are very proud to be from where they're from at the same time as they're adapting to life in America.
There is also issues with some of the kids, of course, about their immigration status. And one of the lines I loved in the book was, no one is illegal, they're just undocumented.
Right. That I love that line, too. And that comes from a quote by the author and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, he said, no human being is illegal. And the gist of the quote was that, you know, human beings can be beautiful or less beautiful, they can be smart or, you know, they can have all these different qualities, but it's inaccurate to say that a human being is legal, which is true from a writer's perspective. You know, a human being can do an act that's illegal, but he himself cannot be illegal. It's just inaccurate to say. So the students were told this constantly by the immigration lawyers who used to visit the school. They would say, don't call yourself illegal. Call yourself undocumented if that's what you are. And it never stuck. And for me, that was frustrating, sad, poignant, all at the same time to see, because what I saw was the kids were constantly hearing the phrase illegal immigrant or illegal alien, and even though they were corrected many times and told to say undocumented, they couldn't get past it. And there's something about calling yourself illegal, especially hearing a child do it, that it criminalizes the person. And so, you know, I think a lot of these kids felt guilty and felt they were doing something really wrong by being here. And in many cases, it wasn't their choice to come here. So it was a fraught issue at the school.
You mentioned their college essays, and a lot of emphasis is put on college at the school. How much emphasis is put on that as opposed to just stabilizing their education, finding out where their level is now, and then moving forward?
There's a lot of emphasis put on college. I think the school really prides itself on creating a pathway to college for the students. That said, the kids are at all different academic levels. So some kids need a lot more stabilizing, a lot more help. And traditionally, a student will go through high school in 4 years, but they're allowed to take more time than that. And so some of the kids are really encouraged to take the time they need, or not encouraged to take longer to graduate, but encouraged to come back, encouraged to not give up. So if it takes longer than 4 years, no one makes fun of these students. They'll come back for a fifth year, they'll come back for a sixth year, however long it takes before they age out of the public school system, because the goal is to graduate and the goal is to go to college. And of course, not everyone makes it, but a really large percentage of the students do make it. And along the way, they get tons of help, not just academically, but so many aspects of their life. They get emotional support. I've seen teachers help students find places to live and jobs. And, you know, I've seen them help students apply for visas, any number of things, because learning the language is just a small fraction of what the students need to do when they get to the United States. They're really learning America.
Still to come, our conversation from 2011 with author Brooke Hauser continues with a guess at how those students might be doing today. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. We're going back in time today to November of 2011 for my conversation with Brooke Hauser, the author of The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens. Towards the end of the book, the students are asked what they think they'll be doing in 20 years. So I asked Brooke how she thinks the students she's become acquainted with will grow into life in the U.S.
Again, it really depends. It's a case-by-case basis. I loved that question. One of the social studies teachers, he had a group of students who he, as all of the teachers do, they have something called advisory, which is a group of students that one teacher or staff member will look after for the course of the year. And at the end of the year, this teacher asked those students, yes, to imagine themselves, what will you be doing in 20 years? And the kids kind of answered for each other because they had gotten to know each other so well. If you were to ask me where do I see the kids who I've written about? Where will they be in 20 years? It would be tough to answer. But one of the girls who I read about named Yasmin, she's a Muslim girl from Yemen. And around the time of her senior year, both of her parents died. And she was suddenly left in this position where she had to raise her younger siblings. And even though it had always been her dream to go to college, suddenly she was considering whether to get married in order to better care for her siblings. So someone like her, you know, it's really difficult to say where she'll be in 20 years. I don't want to say what choice she ultimately made, but my hope is that she'll continue to go to college and that she will find a career for herself and manage to fulfill herself while still meeting all of her family obligations. Some of the kids will return to their native countries, but I think most of them will stay here because they fought to get here. You meet these kids and you realize that they have survived perilous journeys in many cases, literally crossing mountains and deserts, the Himalayas and the Sonoran Desert, on their journey to the United States. So my feeling is that they'll mostly stay here. I already know that many of the kids who I spend time with have gone into college, and they have all different dreams for themselves. They want to become lawyers, doctors, engineers. A couple of them want to become flight attendants or teachers or pharmacists. I mean, it really ranges.
As you were living with these kids and going to the school and dealing with them, were you thinking back to your own high school experience and maybe even comparing the experiences?
Definitely, especially with the prom, because their prom was so different, you know. The kids were really confused by it at first. They asked questions like, is prom a graduation requirement? Do I have to go? Will I be punished if I don't go? And, you know, I can't imagine having to ask a question like that, because in this country, if you go to high school, if you were raised in American public schools or private school, you know what prom is. But also just, you know, it was interesting for me to see that even if a kid was a refugee coming from West Africa who had survived war and horrible trauma, that they still had the problems that every teenager has. They still get upset if they have a pimple on the day they're supposed to go out for a date. They still struggle with certain class assignments and get frustrated at their teachers. They still really have to think about where to sit in the cafeteria and might feel left out if a table of their friends have gathered without them. Where do I sit? Where do I put my tray? So really, there are some very universal themes of just being a teenager. And time and time again, I saw those issues cross boundaries, and, you know, all of the kids at a certain point worried about some of the same stuff that's just typical high school.
This school certainly did take the concept of cliques in the lunchroom to an extreme, didn't it?
Yeah, that was a fun chapter to write. I wrote about the kids, how they subdivide in the cafeteria, and it occurred to me right away that even though the kids really mix together in their classes, and you'll see kids from, you know, every country represented within their academic classes, given to their own devices and left to socialize during lunch, you will see the students separate often according to ethnicity or race or religion or language, some commonality. And at a certain point, just looking out at this cafeteria, I felt that I was looking at a census of New York City, or as many ethnic enclaves as New York has, you would see them in smaller versions in the cafeteria. So the equivalent of Little Italy or Little Uzbekistan, Little Pakistan, and each table would be that little neighborhood kind of condensed. So there was a table where all the Tibetan students would gather, and many of them even knew each other from back home, from their villages. And those kids had grown up as nomadic yak herders or as former farmers, and now they were congregating in the cafeteria wearing much more Americanized clothes, no more yak fur boots. You know, now they're wearing all-stars. But they still stuck together. And then there was a table of West African girls, a couple of whom were already young mothers, and their husbands were Fula West African taxi drivers. And then you would see kids from Mexico at a table together. So the kids, they did seem to really gravitate together. There was another table that I, you know, remember the kids called the Arabic family. And there were all these Yemeni boys who everyone knew that some of them were going to get married before graduation, maybe they would go back home to Yemen to find brides. That was kind of a common occurrence among these students. But while they were at the high school, some of those boys developed huge crushes on Dominican girls who sat only a few feet away. So it was just fun to see all the politics and dynamics play out, you know, in this one place, the school cafeteria.
Brookhauser has written for the New York Times, LA Times, Allure, and Premier magazines, in addition to writing this book, The New Kids, Big Dreams and Brave Journeys at a High School for Immigrant Teens. She recently published Enter Helen, The Invention of Helen Gurley Brown and the Rise of the Modern Single Woman. You can hear her talk about that book on the November 7th, 2016 edition of the program 51%, and we'll include a link to that on our page. The First Amendment to the Constitution gives us freedom of speech, but does that also mean freedom to advertise everywhere? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Advertisements are more pervasive than ever. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Mark Bartholomew, professor of law at the University of Buffalo School of Law, discusses advertisements and the First Amendment.
By some estimates, the average American is exposed to over 3,000 ads in a single day. More and more of these ads are appearing in public spaces, like schools, parklands, and mass transit stations. This phenomenon has one potentially unforeseen consequence. As advertising enters public space, First Amendment law has changed to make it harder for civic authorities to control what kind of advertising can go into that space. Commercial advertising used to receive no First Amendment protection. Even when the Supreme Court changed course in 1976 and decided that commercial speech did warrant some First Amendment shielding, the court still gave government officials wide latitude to police the kinds of advertising they would allow. In recent years, however, the tests for evaluating the constitutionality of advertising restrictions have gotten tougher. As a result, public officials now need to worry about what happens when they let one advertiser into a previously ad-free space. School boards and transportation authorities can face expensive free speech lawsuits for spurning a particular business. Imagine a hypothetical case. A school district bars a merchant from participating in a program that lets businesses pay to have their name and logo printed on student report cards. It's true, such programs do exist. Maybe the district feels that the merchant's particular product is unhealthy or incompatible with its educational mission. A First Amendment challenge would require the district to come up with a compelling reason for excluding the merchant. This burden gets more difficult to satisfy as schools become increasingly commercialized and acquire track records of less than discriminating corporate sponsorship. Under current law, once the advertising genie comes out of the bottle, the First Amendment makes it hard to put him back inside.
That was Mark Bartholomew of the University at Buffalo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.